Welcome to the Natural History Cupboard. Come on in.
And welcome back to the Natural History Cupboard podcast, the place where the weird and wonderful parts of the natural world come together. I'm your host, Gareth, and with me as always is my co-host, Aaron. Aaron, say hi.
Hi.
Hi. What have you been up to this week?
Quite a bit, actually. I have been... The weekend in itself has been a mixed bag of fortune. So yesterday, I did go to... I went out to get some footage for us for this live show that we're doing at the North Devon Library in Barnstaple.
Oh, yeah.
So I went out and I got a little bit of footage, but then the rain came and I thought, you know, I'm not bothered by rain, I'll stay out in it. But then the cloud came. And I'm not talking about the cloud from which the rain came from. I'm talking about cloud that crept along the floor like some dodgy phantom. And
oh, you look stuck in fog.
Oh, the visibility changed on the drop of a penny.
Wow.
And or for our friends across the pond on the drop of a dime. And the visibility became so bad so quickly that I couldn't see more than 5 to 10 meters ahead of me. So the things that I'd gone to this specific location to film weren't going to be visible. And the landscape itself and the view itself were not going to be visible either. So I turned back. I paid for the parking, the fuel to get there, obviously, the parking to park there, which is extortionate in this particular place, I will add. And I walked, all in all, probably only walked half an hour, which was not the plan. I wanted a bit more of an enjoyable walk. And I got absolutely drenched very quickly. I was absolutely soaked. So I sent a message complaining to Atta about it and drove home very miserable. And then today I was annoyed. But today, probably the best day of the year so far, I reckon.
It was relatively clear. I mean, I was driving,
it was warm.
I was driving down the country most of the day, so I've had on and off weather as I've been going from North Wales to here.
Changed locations on the way down, yeah.
I seem to have just been following the edge of the rain the entire way.
I could see the south of Wales. We went to Dunster Castle.
Very nice.
Me, Atta, and our daughter. And yeah, it was really nice. Saw a, I'm going to get the name wrong now,
Ginkgo biloba.
Yes, which is a tree that has been around and possibly even fed some of the dinosaurs. So that was cool. So the last couple of days we've been experiencing a interesting behavior. Very early in the morning, we start hearing the very angry call of a bird just outside the window, and we're wondering what it is. Anyway, we eventually decided to actually get out of bed and have a look yesterday. And it turned out to be a little house sparrow who is kind of stood on the wire, screaming at us through the window for no reason, which is pretty interesting. Anyway, we were discussing it, and I proposed that it was probably to do with him seeing his reflection. But Atta actually Googled it, and yes, it is to do with him seeing his reflection. He's a young house sparrow seeing his reflection early in kind of, you know,
little Asbo sparrow just going, "Come on in, I'll have you."
That's exactly what it is. He's just being territorial with his own reflection. Anyway, he actually ended up standing on the window, like not on the windowsill, on the like the white part of the window,
on the window frame, on the open, yeah.
Looking at his reflection, like, "Come on, then, come on, I love you." I managed to get some good photos once he'd moved back to the wire, which I'll pop them up in a bit. Actually, I'll pop
send them over, and we can put them up on Winged Wednesday,
on
our Facebook page. Well, I have not had much to do this week. It's been straight into assessments with my students, so it's been most of the week. We have had some brand new little baby Amazonian milk frogs come into the animal center, which are very cute and are voracious predators. For something that is no bigger than your fingernail, at that sort of size, they eat like you wouldn't believe, and they throw themselves at their prey. They are amazing to watch eat. They're really cool. Apart from that, actually, I'd say it's been a rather amphibian-esque week because just today, I suppose, when we've just started planting some new veg out for the year, getting all the seedlings and everything getting going, just doing a bit of pottering around in the garden, in the greenhouse, loads of toads under the old pots and everything. So I've been turfing them out of the greenhouse so they don't get stepped on and into the rockery. And setting up a pond for some frogs. I'll be digging that in over the coming weeks.
Nice.
I think it should work quite well. Right. Well, shall we hop on into our news for this week?
Yes, let's do it. Ribbit.
It's the news.
Right, well, we're into the news for this week. Aaron, tell us all about it.
Well, every week, the weird and wonderful world of natural history offers up an embarrassment of riches when it comes to news and interesting stories. And though we here at the Natural History Cupboard are but a small team, it's our aim to keep you, our fellow cupboard dwellers, up to date on the good, the odd, and the exciting. So let's open up the Natural History Cupboard newsreel, where we've compiled some of our more interesting headlines, and dive in. And I think I've got the first article, and that is coming to us from fizz.org. Even inactive deep sea smokers are densely colonized by microbial communities, study shows. So microbial communities can thrive in the most extreme inhospitable environments, and this includes the inactive hydrothermal vents of the deep sea. Found on the seafloor, the mineral-rich chimneys of hydrothermal vents have long been known to cater to a vast diversity of species. What happens when these vents go dormant? Well, a new study suggests that whilst other organisms move on, the microbial communities adapt to the new conditions, and the research project behind it aims to sample the first hydrothermal vents discovered 40-odd years ago in the East Pacific.
That's a new intro that you've been playing with there, and it's very nice.
Yeah, I tried to make it more optimistic.
right, well, my first article comes from the BBC, and it's Wiltshire Town to make life-size sculpture of an aurochs. You may remember that we have talked about aurochs in the past.
We have.
This is a prehistoric animal, obviously, that roamed Europe and Britain 4,000 years ago, and is to be celebrated in a new piece of artwork. The aurochs was the domestic cow's ancestor, and it is being celebrated by the Amesbury Historic Centre, and it's bidding for a grant to build a life-size model of the animal made out of mosaic tiles. The community can help design and build the sculpture, said volunteer Mark Verbinnen. And speaking to BBC Wiltshire, he said, there's a valley coming down from Stonehenge to Amesbury, and it's believed that the valley would have been used at one point to herd the aurochs into one specific place. At the lowest point, they would have been stuck, and you would have been able to have a massive herd there. Each would have fed up to 300 people. And now, I don't actually see how that's possible. Each aurochs would have fed 300 people. That seems a little optimistic.
It does.
I mean, aurochs are big, but they're not the size of a mammoth, you know.
Unless they had, at that time, you know,
very small people.
Well, I was thinking like maybe 300 people being fed by like some sort of celebrity chef like Jamie Oliver, or, you know, someone who doesn't do proper steak, tiny little steaks for tiny little people.
Somehow I doubt that they've got their figures right on that. But anyway, it will be nice to see a model of an aurochs, an animal that once used to roam the UK countryside.
Yeah. So my next article, it comes to us from fizz.org again. And this one is scientists find hundreds of unique species in Africa's newest and most threatened ecoregion. 30 scientific expeditions across 20 years of biological surveying in southern Africa has revealed an embarrassment of riches. There's that term again. I like that term this week. In terms of undocumented biodiversity, the findings have been published in scientific reports and were so significant that the global team of scientists behind it deemed it necessary to declare the spot an entirely new ecoregion. Southeast Africa Montane Archipelago, or SEMA, is the name of this area, and it covers an area from northern Mozambique to Mount Mulanje in Malawi and shelters no less than 127 plant species and 90 animal species, all of which are endemic and were previously unknown to science.
Ah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So my next one also comes from the BBC, as my previous one. And this is Fukuyama residents warned not to touch cat after chemical tank fall.
Yes, I saw this.
So sounding like the start of a Godzilla film, essentially. But the residents of a city in Western Japan have been warned to stay away from a cat after it fell into a tank of poisonous chemicals. Isn't that the Joker's origins as well?
It's one of many Joker origins.
So if we get sort of a Joker-cat hybrid in Japan, we know where it's come from. The warning comes after a factory worker found yellow paw prints leading away from the container. Security footage was then reviewed, and the cat could be seen running away, leaving a trail of paw prints. Officials in Fukuyama have asked the public to stay away from the animal and report any sightings to the police. I mean, this is just a cat. Not many cats, just a cat. Mm. It's thought that the curious feline may have been in a vat of hexylent chromium, a highly acidic and carcinogenic chemical, which is orange and brown in color. A member of staff found the paw prints and as they arrived for work at the plant, and according to the news website, he then reported them to the police. The environmental team warned that the public should not touch the cat, as it seems abnormal. Although, to be honest, if it's that carcinogenic to humans and everything, I think the cat's probably dead.
Yeah, you would have you'd
think so,
right?
And it does say much later in the article, the cat may have died as a result of the incident. So it may be a bit of a non-story in that sense, but well, poor cat in the sense that it's fallen into a vat of highly corrosive, highly horrible chemicals. But yeah, I mean, that sounds like the start of some sort of B horror film.
Yeah,
yet again,
somewhere between Godzilla and Joker, like you said. Also, if it was that much a danger, if its existence and its the proximity to humans was such a problem, why didn't they contain it? Because the first thing that comes to my head is if that animal died and it hasn't like corroded into nothingness from this stuff, then some sort of other animal will eat it, surely.
Yeah.
And then that will carry on until that finally carcasses it too.
Why wasn't this place more secure in that a cat can get in?
Yes, that is true. Why do we ask these questions? So my final article of the reel comes to us from Science Daily, and that is that Alaska dinosaur tracks reveal a lush, wet environment. A trackway displaying dinosaur tracks found in northwestern Alaska has tree stumps and other plant life fossilized alongside it, revealing a much more tropical landscape existed in this location some 100 million years ago, a time when dinosaurs were navigating the journey here from what is now modern-day Asia. The research is detailed in the journal Geosciences and gives a window into what the world was like during the hottest part of the Cretaceous period.
Mm. My final article comes from fizz.org, and newly discovered fossil of giant turtle is named after Stephen King novel character. This is an international research team led by Dr. Gabriel S. Ferreira and the Senckenberg Center for Human Evolution and Paleoenvironment at the University of Tunenburg has described a new species of giant turtle from the late Pleistocene. I can say Pleistocene and everything like that, but I struggle to pronounce people's names. So, Heltocephalus maturina has been described to have lived 40,000 between 40,000 and 9,000 years ago, and comes from the Brazilian Amazon with a shell length of about 180 centimeters. The species is one of the largest known freshwater turtles in the world, the armored reptile was named after the giant turtle Maturina, a fictional character created by best-selling author Stephen King. We named the new species after the giant turtle Maturina, an overarching protagonist in Stephen King's multiverse Maturina. It's responsible for the creation of the universe in King's novels and films, explained Dr. Fiera. Not being overly familiar with a lot of Stephen King's novels, I wasn't exactly sure who it was named after. I was hoping it'd be like, I don't know, Shawshanky Eye or something like that, you know. One of the ones I'd heard of, but no, I was unaware of his giant turtle that's in Stephen King's works. But yeah, new giant fossil species of turtle. So pretty cool.
Good news. And that wraps it up just about for this week's installment of the Natural History Cupboard Newsreel. Remember, if you guys at home have news articles or topics of interest that you think we should cover, send them in. You can use any of the usual ways to contact us, whether by email or social media, or indeed you can send a radioactive cat our way and see if that gets a message to us. And doing so might just see your chosen article covered here or in our natural history news discussion.
Might also see us turned into giant radioactive monsters as well.
That is true. With that said, our natural history news discussion this week is coming to us from Life Science. And the headline is, what does python taste like? Because it could be slivering onto our dinner plates. Okay, so I'm throwing up the trigger warning here, as I feel we'll all have strong opinions on this. But a study undertaken on two snake farms has suggested that breeding Burmese and reticulated pythons for meat is more energy and resource efficient than current livestock farming options. As a low effort and sustainable farming practice, snake meat may become a viable protein alternative, according to this research. Scientists refer to several potential benefits from farming snakes, including fast growth rates of the animals themselves, low feeding requirements. They also maintain body mass and conditioning during periods of fasting. They have low water requirements. They reach large body sizes and have low spatial requirements too. And minimal waste production, as well as high reproductive potential, around 100 eggs per year. These are all attributes that seem to lend themselves well to answering the challenges of supplying the growing demand while still meeting sustainability standards. Whilst pretty much limited to Asia, snake farming has expanded in recent years. The snakes in the study were fed on a varied diet of chicken, wild-caught rodents, fish meal, chicken pellets, and waste products from pork production, receiving these meals once per week, which, for those of you who may be unfamiliar with snake metabolism and snake husbandry, that's pretty standard across the board. Some snakes may even fast for longer periods, and in fact, royal pythons are well known to be difficult feeders at times. They were observed to pack on up to 46 grams per day over a 12-month period, by the end of which they were large enough to be used for meat and other byproducts. Roughly a quarter of the food consumed was converted to meat, and by the study's conclusion, 82% of the snake's body mass was edible meat. This is a massive leap from the 63% of a cow's body mass that actually ends up being edible. The efficiency is actually higher than all major farm species, including poultry, pork, beef, salmon, and crickets. There are also two potential untapped benefits snake farming could bring to the table. The first is pest control, maintaining low levels of rodents by maintaining a captive snake population, for example. And the second is the potential to upcycle waste products from other meat industries. That being said, I do have some concerns with this. The identified benefit of low space requirements. Now, that is a big one for me, because maybe this is simply a misinterpretation on my part. So if they mean low in relation to the requirements of other species like cattle, then I don't actually have an issue with this statement. However, the wording does leave it open, and I'll admit this is the wording of the article itself, not anything else. but the wording of the article leaves it open to an interpretation that is rife in the exotic pet domain and also sometimes in zoos, unfortunately, too. And that is simply that snakes don't need much space. It used to be that the guidance for snake housing was that an enclosure was large enough when a snake basically covered one quarter of the floor space within when it was coiled up. Okay, I think we'll all agree that that isn't really enough space at all for a snake. Certainly not if you want your snake to exercise and be healthy and live a full and happy life. The guidance is now improved, but I use that in air quotation marks because I don't particularly think it's improved all that much. Nowadays, the guidance says that your pet should be able to stretch its body out. So the snake should be able to be completely straight. It should have enough space to kind of lay out completely straight. Now, I'll admit, we'll all agree, I think, that this is far better than just being able to curl up in one quarter of the box that it's in. However, I really don't think it goes far enough. And I personally think that spatial requirements for housing snakes should include a more three-dimensional look at it rather than just considering a floor plan size. Even snakes that aren't particularly burrowers will burrow, and even snakes that aren't particularly climbers will climb. And it's healthy for them to be able to have those options to do so because it works muscles that are otherwise unused if they're just slithering along a flat surface. So if this interpretation is indeed the intended meaning, then I fear we're looking at the practice of keeping snakes in what is essentially a racking system of school trays. Do you remember at school you'd either have a little plastic tray under your workbench, or you'll have like a shelf rack system with everybody's trays racked up above.
Annoyingly, though, I never had a snake in my school drawers or anything. I'd have loved that. That would have been
know. As a kid, that would be far better than the workbooks I had. But
yeah, definitely. But no, I would not like to see snakes. I can't stand the idea of keeping snakes in a rack system. Just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've got two friends that I know of. I say friends, I've not seen them in a long time. Two people that I guess they're friends, yeah. Yeah, two friends I know of who used to, at the very least, like I said, not seen them in a long time. They used to keep their snakes in this kind of racking system. But worse than that, I know of a fair few zoos that use this racking system too, which is quite disappointing because I don't find it at all appropriate for snakes. It's not very nice. It's used for their handling snakes as well. So it'll be corn snakes, milk snakes, king snakes, that kind of thing will be what's in this rack. That's my first concern with this. I mean, there are many concerns and I may have missed some in this. Also, in the exotic pet world, this continuing talking about this space, the neglectful space allowance usually goes hand in hand with the malpractice. I and that's my opinion, but it's a very strong opinion I have. The malpractice of keeping pet snakes on a substrate of flat sheets of newspaper, which whilst necessary on occasion, such as when medicating for mites, for example, it's not a viable option for general husbandry practices. We should be keeping them. At the very least, you should be keeping them on you know, the pet store-bought, you know, is it Aspen or Cypress substrate. I generally think now that I think if I had a snake now, I used to have snakes. If I had my snakes now, they would probably be on something more like soil that I would have sorted through to make sure it was all right for them. Sourced responsibly as well to make sure it was healthy for them. But yeah, I would probably have them on some sort of substrate, maybe not soil, but some sort of substrate that more closely emulates what they would have in the wild. So long as it was healthy, clean, and well vetted for them. And I'd also be thinking about bioactive enclosures as well at this stage in my life. I really don't like the spatial guidance is given to prospective pet owners, and I really don't like the practice of of having them in trays or having them just on newspaper sheets, flat newspaper sheets. So these two concepts that I'm fearing will be introduced in an agricultural setting lead me to the worry that snakes will experience their very own form of battery farming. And if these animals are to be kept, they should be kept to high standards. And if they are to be farmed, then I still stand by this sentiment. If we have to farm animals to feed us, then we should be, at the very least, making sure that they live happy and full and comfortable lives right up until that moment where they have to be where they are slaughtered. Lastly, I say my final concern. It's not my final concern. I have a lot of concerns over this, but it's one of those things where we could talk forever on this. So the concern that I'm going to end my part in this discussion on is the ethical question of, is farming for meat facilitating the harvesting of byproducts, or are the snakes being harvested for other products and the meat itself is the byproduct? Because even though on its surface, the practice and the result might seem like the same, I feel the ethical motivations are different, and that is important, because on the one hand, you're using the animal for food, and then you're ensuring that nothing that isn't food is wasted. So the whole animal gets used as best as possible. On the other hand, you're killing these animals for leather or traditional medicine trades, and then hiding behind the front of meat production. And I not only do I feel that this is an important differentiation, I also feel that it's one that you have to take a strong stance on.
Yeah, no, I mean I could not really agree more. I don't think I could find any possible area to even add to that, Aaron. It's pretty much my views on it. The idea of keeping snakes in a racking system to then have in a warehouse is tantamount to battery farming. And I feel that because it's a reptile, it will be seen as somehow less deserving of animal rights. Yep. in a lot of people's minds, when that's simply not true. Snakes are intelligent enough animals to deserve, I mean, the fact that they're an animal anyway, they deserve a certain amount of rights when it comes to things like that. So, yeah, my only thought on it, and I know everyone says this, oh, things like taste like chicken, because most people haven't actually eaten any exotic meat. I've tried snake once years ago, and I thought it tasted awful. I've tried alligator and I've tried crocodile as well, and they both tasted awful as well. Like, really bland, really boring. I'm not so sure I'd be overly keen on it, you know?
Yeah,
it doesn't grab me as tasting good. Something about every reptile that I've tried meat of reptiles has never tasted any good. And yeah, I think it'd just be really kind of, eh. I'm surprised at the fact that it's, do you say it was better than crickets in the sense of production wise?
Yes, in the sense of getting edible meat from it, it is apparently better than cricket.
I mean, I would quite happily have stuff made out of crickets again, because I tried that and yeah, that was pretty good. You know, I mean, in a burger and that, you would not know the difference. And I suppose you could say the same for snake as well. It probably wouldn't be much different. But I can ethically get by with keeping invertebrates in large amount, you know, large warehouses and that, because their requirements are actually about what you would end up giving the snake, and they'd be fine with it. And it would be a large enough space for them. But yeah, I can't really get behind the idea of farming snakes. And I know I'm a hypocrite, because I know I quite happily will eat a piece of meat. You know, more and more I find myself becoming more vegetarian in things like that. But I do like a nice steak. So
well, here's the thing, Gareth, and this is, people don't like it when I say this. And it doesn't matter what side of any argument you fall on, people don't like it when I say it, but in life, especially when it comes to the environment and nature and stuff, you are either a hypocrite or what would be a politically correct term for this? As in, not politically correct, but how can I say this without swearing? you're either a hypocrite or you're just not a very nice person. And I'd rather be a hypocrite than not a nice person. And what I mean by hypocrite is that we all preach this, that we want a better world, want better environment and stuff, but you won't be perfect. Nobody can be perfect. And there are things that I can do in my life, things that I can change in my life that, Gareth, you won't be able to do or change in your life. And there'll be things that you can do and change in your life that I can't do. And this is going to be the same for all individuals. So wouldn't you rather preach all this stuff so that everybody knows all the information they can possibly know and then can select the things that they can do
and try and do change?
People at our level are not the ones causing the most damage on this planet. We can only do what we can possibly do to help. It's the rich that need to do the mega changes, you know. So just do what you can do, and that will automatically make you a hypocrite, but that's fine because it means that you're at least trying. I do just want to recover a couple things quickly. So the article never says that they're going to be put in a racking system.
Just want to make it clear.
Exactly. I took that interpretation. I'd assume to be able to get what they want out of this and to mass produce meat.
I love the idea of them having big open fields with just loads of snakes.
Can you imagine the rolling green fields of Devon? And there's no cows out today.
No, it's just snakes. No.
We got the Burmese out instead. Or where is he? Oh, he's wrapping himself around Farmer Giles's sheep.
My other thought is it's going to be lots of very long, thin fields. Yeah. You know, so the snake is stretched out. It's basically lots of tubes lined up against
each other. The other thing I wanted to just recover is retread is the actual wording is the efficiency is actually higher than all major farmed species, including poultry, pork, beef, salmon, and crickets. I guess that means that the yield is bigger and it takes less time to do. But I don't know.
I suppose you don't have to put as much food into a reptile as you do to a lot of other animals, and even crickets and that will eat a lot.
Yeah. I think in closing, I would like to know exactly how they propose to do this. I'd be open to learning about it, but at the moment, I'm not sure because what I wouldn't like to do is to jump from one, let's be honest, one exploitative concept to another. I think we should be trying to move every move that we. There's no point doing a horizontal move. If we're going to move, let's move up. You know.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, I can't see it catching on here anytime soon, but you never know.
Well, one thing the article does go into, which I didn't bother putting in because I thought the people that will be listening to this, whilst they may suffer from it, they will probably understand that snakes have a place and are good animals in general. But it does mention that one major hurdle they're going to have to get through is snake fear if they're to bring it outside of Asia.
Hmm. Fair enough. Hmm. Right. Well, should we slither on our way and into our creature feature for this week?
Let's do it.
Oh, dear.
It's the creature feature.
Well, this week, Aaron, we are about to head as far south as you can possibly go. We are going south. In fact, we've only ventured this far south a handful of times on the podcast with animals such as the sheathbill, the orca, Prylophosaurus, I think maybe even with the sperm whale, perhaps, but I can't remember whether we went this far south. But we are back in the Antarctic, back in the chill of the coldest place on the planet.
Excellent.
Do you remember if the sperm whale one went this far? I know sperm whales do go this far, but I can't
remember. The creature feature didn't, no. I think I mentioned where, like, their entire range, but that wasn't where the creature feature was focused to, no.
Ah, right. Well, just imagine, if you will, Aaron, you're going on a hypothetical here again. You're part of a crew. It's around 1820-ish. So you're there in your very much woolen clothes, keeping you warm. You are probably freezing to death anyway. You're a group of seal hunters down reaping the rich bounty of wildlife in and around the Antarctic and its various different islands. Your captain is an American called Captain John Davis. And he, well, he's quite experienced around this particular part of the world. So much so, he in fact has had the claim, and he's probably told you this as part of his crew, he claims to be the first person to have made a landing on the Antarctic mainland on the 7th of February, 1821. However, this isn't exactly accepted by all historians, so he might just be lying to you lot just to keep you happy and make him seem bigger and bolder than he actually is.
Right.
As you sit there in your boat, you are basically looking for seals and whales to catch and to kill. Not a very nice thing, but at this particular point in history, fuels a massive amount of industry, seal hunting and whale hunting right around the Southern Hemisphere. As your boat slips through the ice floes, you see a little group of Adélie penguins. Now, they are on an ice floe. The ice floe itself is sort of bobbing slightly on either side, and the penguins themselves look quite agitated. They're moving on this ice floe in a way that is as if the water has become lava, has become lethal to these very skilled seabirds. And as you watch, as you sort of slip past slowly, one of these brave birds, or maybe silly, decides to make the plunge, and in an attempt to get back to the nearby shoreline, it disappears into the inky black water, only to resurface at high speed past your longboat as it jets out of the water and dives back in again. Now, as this one does that, this obviously has given some of the other ones a bit of an idea to make the plunge as well, and another one does the same, except this time it doesn't resurface. As the rest of the flock then make the same break for shore and continue to keep on moving, they go past you. You notice that second bird just did not resurface until now. It resurfaces not of its own volition, but in the huge jaws of this week's creature, the leopard seal. It holds its head slightly above the water for a second, looking at these odd apes in a boat before crunching down on its lovely penguin supper, and then just slipping below the waterline. What you've seen as an early explorer and early whaler in this part of the world puts a chill down your spine more than the minus 20 degree temperatures that are currently breaking through your rather primitive clothing. At the thought of such a silent predator lurking in the icy cold depths. But is this really the monster it should be seen as? Well, we're going to hopefully have a look at what makes a leopard seal a leopard seal, and if they are in fact the monsters that they're made out to be. What is a leopard seal? The leopard seal, otherwise known by its scientific names as, in fact, Aaron, tell us what it is, because I spent a while trying to get this.
It's Hydroga leptonyx.
Yep. Is a member of the true seal family and is the only species in the genus Hydroga. Now, Hydroga itself means water worker. Were you aware of that, Aaron?
I didn't know it meant water worker. I knew Hydra would be something to do with water.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
obvious, I guess.
I suppose, yeah. But it's still a bit of an odd one. Water worker, and leptonyx is Greek for small clawed. So it's the small clawed water worker, which I think is a really underwhelming scientific name for this animal. You know, I'd have thought something more like Aatrox, which means fierce, or, you know, something with a bit more punch to it than water worker. Makes it just sound like someone who's working in a factory. Anyway, yeah. It being a true seal, you might be asking now, what is a true seal? Well, both of us can give a fairly good idea as to what these are, because both of us have worked with both true and eared seals, or earless and eared seals. You may be more familiar with them as sea lions and harbor seals, or common seals, or in the case of this, leopard seals. So there's two major groups of what are called pinnipeds. Now, the pinnipeds basic means fin-footed in Latin, and they're broken into two major groups. You've got Phoaseidae, which is the true seals, and they're best described, certainly in their motion, as slugs, the way that they move, because they have their flippers very much towards the very back of their body and can't use them on land. They can use their front flippers, and they tend to do sort of an almost bouncing, slipping motion a lot of the time when they are out on land. They're very ungraceful on the land, but they are fantastic little creatures. And as true seals, they don't have external ears, as in ear lobes, the bits that stick out on the side of your head. They still have ear openings, but they are just not anything more than external ears. Now, their body size is generally smaller than most of the eared seals. However, there are some exceptions to this. Obviously, things like the elephant seals are the largest and are utterly massive things. And in fact, the creature that we're talking about today, the leopard seal, is also quite a large species of seal. But most of the seals that you'd be familiar with, things like common seals, harbor seals, they're smaller than their sea lion or eared seal cousins. Now, their front flippers are quite good for pulling themselves on the ground, but apart from that, they're better in the water. Now, the sea lions, or the eared seals, or Oratoridae, they have the ability to use their rear flippers on the ground and can actually run at a decent speed. They are impressively fast when they want to be. And I can say that with some certainty, as I had a bull Australian sea lion run through the middle of a group of us as we were walking down a beach. And it moved faster than a lot of people, I would say. So their front flippers, they can use them as well to lift themselves up off the ground. And they can actually hold their body relatively high off the ground when they move. They obviously have ears, even though they're quite small. And you don't tend to see them much when they're in the water. And a lot of the eared seals tend to have, manes, hence why they get the name sea lions, because they look like they've got a big fluffy area around their neck. Nothing anywhere as close to what an actual lion looks like, but still exaggerated enough to look like that. Now, for anyone in the UK, we only have seals, true seals. That's the common seal and the grey seal. If you're in North America, you'll be seeing both, possibly, depending on where you live. If you live on the Atlantic coast, you'll see true seals, the common and the gray seal. Depending on how far north you go, you may encounter things like ringed seals as well. If you live on the west coast of America, you'll encounter the sea lion, the Stella's sea lion, as well as harbor seals and common seals as well. So you get a mix of them there. If you're in Australia, you've got the Australian sea lion and you've got the fur seal as well. And you may even have our particular creature from this creature feature visiting you as well. We'll get onto their distribution in a minute. But as a general rule, that's how the two of them are told apart. What's your favorite, Aaron? Seals or sea lions? True seals or eared seals?
That's a difficult one. I think it's probably going to end up being true seals.
Yeah?
I
find it hard to pick between the two, because the walrus falls into the eared seals, but the leopard seal falls into the true seals. So,
and that's kind of the line where I struggled. Apart from instead of leopard seals, I was thinking of our local seals. I'm very fond of them.
They are very cool. So leopard seals have a distinctively long muscular body shape when compared to other seals. They just look muscular. They look, jacked is probably the best way to put it. Their overall length is roughly about 2.4 to 3.5 meters in length, which is an utterly massively long animal as well. They can weigh anywhere up to 600 kilos, and leopard seals are the second largest species of seal found in the Antarctic Only the southern elephant seal grows larger. They get a much, much heavier weight to them and get utterly massive as well. To give you an idea of their size, where they can grow up to 4,000 kilos, there is a really good bit of footage of David Attenborough on a beach, I think either in Antarctica or South Georgia, walking up to some elephant seals with just a stick to keep them at bay. Or those other classic videos that you see every now and again of elephant seals just turning up in parts of New Zealand or Australia and just deciding to sit on people's cars. Nothing you can do about it because it weighs 4,000 kilos. And you just have to deal with it. Anyway, this predator is perhaps best known for its massive jaws, which makes it one of the top predators in its environment. The front teeth are sharp like those of other carnivores, but their molars, interestingly enough, lock together in a way that allows them to actually sieve krill from the water in a manner similar to their relative, the crab-eater seal. It's really fascinating. If you've ever seen the molars of a leopard seal, if not, I'd highly recommend you go and look them up now, because they actually have these almost like intricate little grooves in them that look like someone's carved them, that allow them to lock together and sieve out krill. So they can eat smaller stuff and eat considerably larger stuff as well. Their coat is a counter shaded with silver to dark gray, blending into sort of a distinctive spotted leopard pattern on their back, with a paler white to light gray coloration underneath. Now, the whiskers are short and also clear as well, so you don't tend to see them too much. When we tend to think of seals and sea lions, they usually have quite large, quite easy to see whiskers that are used for sensing things. But the leopard seals are all really hard to spot. So as true seals as well, they don't have external ears or pinnae, but possess internal ear canals that lead to an external opening. So basically, it is a small hole on the side of their head. Their hearing in the air as well, you might think because they're an aquatic animal, their hearing wouldn't be any good, but their hearing is similar to that of a human. But scientists have noted that leopard seals use their ears in conjunction with their whiskers as well, underwater to help track prey. So they can hear relatively well in the water. And sound does travel really far underwater as well. It just acts in very different ways to how it does in the air. And we'll get on to how they do things underwater in a bit. So at the start of our story, we had Aaron in a boat. And I bet, Aaron, did you think you were going to get, you know, knocked over from the boat and torn to pieces or something?
No, my assumption was that we would voluntarily be getting off onto some of the sea ice. And I would end up being chased by one.
Well, it's one of the possible ways that people could have come across this seal. But it was really hard to actually find who was the first person to have discovered leopard seals. And it's for a very good reason. Exploration in the Antarctic took place after the fact that these guys had been discovered. And you will find that leopard seals primarily live in the Antarctic pack ice. So that's the loose floating ice that is just offshore. They're actually known as what is called hagiophilic, which it means ice loving, which that means that they spend most of their time in and around the ice floes, primarily inhabiting the pack ice somewhere around 50 degrees south to 80 degrees south. If you imagine the Antarctic, at the bottom of the world, it is basically a circle, and then you've got all of those lines of latitude heading up. So they're sort of primarily in that band. But during the autumn and winter, some of these animals actually do disperse northward throughout the Southern Ocean, sometimes visiting New Zealand, the Falkland Islands, Australia, South Africa, and many other southern parts of the world. So as I was saying, we've not really, you know, had a first person to have discovered this animal. It's very hard to have found who first saw them in Antarctica, but we do know that peoples in Australia and New Zealand, as well as in South Africa, had seen them previously to this point of Antarctica being properly explored. So we know that the first formal description of a leopard seal actually came before the first supposed landing by your captain, Aaron,
on the Antarctic mainland. In 1820, as opposed to your captain, who said that he landed there in 1821, the first formal description came from a French zoologist, an anatomist, called Henri Marie Delacourt de la Bonneville. One hell of a name. He described the leopard seal in 1820. Interesting fun fact as well with this. Apart from being someone who there is very little information on, he's actually famous for also coining the term paleontology.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So he described the first leopard seal, presumably brought back as a dead specimen, to France from somewhere in and around the Southern Hemisphere. But yeah, there was very little information actually laying out where or how this first one was encountered. But most leopard seals remain within the pack ice throughout the year and remain solitary during most of their lives, for the exception of mothers and their newborn. They will actually form what are called matrilineal groups. They can actually end up moving further north in the austral winter, which is our, in the Northern Hemisphere's, summer, to subantarctic islands and to the coastlines of places like New Zealand and Australia to provide care for their pups, basically going to places where it's just a slight bit easier for them to eke out a living. While solitary animals may appear in areas of lower latitudes, and these are usually adults without offspring or adult males or females. So females will rarely breed there, and some research believe that this is due to safety concerns for their pups. Lone males, leopard seals hunt other marine mammals and penguins in amongst the pack ice, and could in fact pose a threat to any pups that are around there. All of these factors combined, the fact that they live within a very restricted band of the world's waters, that they live in amongst the pack ice and are usually solitary, make them quite hard to spot for conservationists. And because of that, there are only estimates on their world population that aren't particularly great estimates either. They put the estimated population of this species anywhere from 222,000 to 440,000 individuals. So, right. You know, little bit of discrepancy there. Putting leopard seals as least concern. Although there is an abundance of leopard seals in the Antarctic, they are difficult to survey in traditional techniques. This is done using either hydrophones, listening out for their calls, or basically sitting there in a boat with a pair of binoculars and looking for them. So it's a hard process to try and count these individuals, hence that major discrepancy in their numbers. And as they spend long periods of time vocalizing under the water surface during the austral spring and summer, their solitary existence have made the leopard seal populations almost impossible to estimate. However, thankfully, we can say that this is a species that has never really been threatened by hunting pressures. There are much easier seals to try and find, catch, and kill. They do have that going for them, at least. So let's get to the diet, the part where leopard seals are most famous for knowing. Leopard seals are opportunistic feeders. They'll feed on anything ranging from krill to squid and fish, but adult seals probably switch from just eating a very smaller diet of things like krill to more substantial prey, including king penguin, Adelie penguin, rockhopper, gentoo, emperor, chinstrap, when they get older and become more practiced in hunting them. They've also been known less frequently to actually eat Weddell, crab eater, and Ross seals, and even the young of southern elephant seals. They're also known to occasionally take the pups of young leopard seals as well. As I was saying before, their teeth are unique. Their molars are trident-shaped, with these weird little grooves in between them, allow them to actually filter feed as they swim through krill, very much similar to crab eater seals and Weddell seals. As they swim, they'll open their mouths, gape in, and then just filter feed, just like whales do, really. The canine teeth can be anywhere up to 2.5 centimeters long, and their main job is to catch, grab, and hold on to their prey and rip it to pieces. While the rest of the teeth are obviously designed for crushing, cutting, and tearing up their food. So when hunting for penguins, the leopard seal
essentially patrols the water's edge near the ice, almost completely submerged, just popping up every now and again, just waiting for a bird to enter the water, and then it will race after it and kill it by grabbing its feet, shaking it violently, and beating its body against the ice or the water until the bird is dead, basically.
Mm.
Previous reports stating that leopard seals actually skin their prey before feeding have actually been found to be incorrect, as they lack the teeth necessary to slice into the skin and sort of peel it off like a banana, I suppose. You know, as it's flailing around, there are lots of videos of these leopard seals holding pretty mangled penguins, and probably the most famous one is, I don't know whether you've seen it, Aaron, I think it was in a BBC documentary, where a diver has a leopard seal bring him
a
Adelie penguin for him to basically eat.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Would have been equal parts amazing and utterly terrifying at the same time. You may be wondering as well, what do leopard seals have to fear? Well, they've only really got two things to fear.
Well, let us tell you.
True. They only have really two things to fear. One is man, obviously, because let's face it, everything's got to fear us because we're absolute irritations. The other one is probably no surprise to you in any way, shape, or form. It's that psychopathic panda of the sea, the orca. They are about the only thing that catch and eat these guys in the wild, as you could probably expect. I think everything has to fear the orca. Yeah, the orca. Okay, so as I was saying before, leopard seals are known to make a huge variety of different vocalizations. These are used to communicate with others of their own species, obviously. And males can produce, or have been known to produce, up to at least five different types of sound. The way that they're described is what's called a high double trill, a medium single trill, low descending trill, low double trill, hoots with single low trill. And these sounds are presumably part of a long-range acoustic display for territorial purposes or to attract a mate. And females are known to vocalize when they have elevated reproductive hormones as well in their body, helping them to find a mate. They also have been known to use these calls, the females that is, to call their pups back to them after returning after a foraging trip in amongst the ice, which makes it obviously a lot easier. Now, as I said, they only have two things to fear, one being the orca, the other being humans. And leopard seals are large predators and presenting a potential risk to humans. Obviously, if we enter their environment, they pose a risk to us. We probably pose a bigger risk to them long term anyway. However, attacks on humans are rare. There are some, but they are rare. Most human perceptions of leopard seals are shaped by these historic encounters, which have become sort of tall tales and become the way that people think about leopard seals. And most of these were during the early days of Antarctic exploration. Examples of aggressive behavior, such as stalking and attacks, have been documented, but they are, as I said, rare. And this was a leopard seal that attacked Thomas Ord Les, a member of Sir Ernest Shackleton's Imperial Trans Expedition in 1914. When he was camping out on the sea ice, which just sounds delightful and cold and horrible. The leopard seal, about 12 foot long and 1,100 pounds, chased Order Les on the ice. He was saved only when another member of the expedition, Frank Wild, shot the beast. So that's one description. In 1985, a Canadian-British explorer, Gareth Wood, was bitten twice on the leg when a leopard seal tried to drag him off the ice and into the sea. His companions managed to save him by repeatedly kicking the animal in the head with their crampons on their boots.
Wow.
That's going to hurt for him and for the seal. So it sounds like a bit of a case of opportunistic predation there, but he survived. The one that I'm going to talk about now is the only known death by leopard seal. And it was in 2003, a biologist, Kirsty Brown, of the British Antarctic Survey, was killed by a leopard seal while conducting research, snorkeling in Antarctica. This is the first known recorded human fatality by leopard seal. She was part of a team of four researchers taking part in an underwater survey at the South Cove near the UK's Rothera Research Station. Brown and another researcher, Richard Burt, were snorkeling in the water. Burt was snorkeling at a distance of 15 meters away from Brown when the team heard a scream and saw Brown disappear deeper into the water. She was rescued by the team, but they were unable to resuscitate her. And it was later revealed that the seal had held her underwater for 6 minutes at a depth of 70 meters, drowning her. Furthermore, she suffered a total of 45 separate injuries, everything from bites and scratches, most of which were concentrated around her head and neck. Wow. As Brown was snorkeling at the time, the thought is it may have been mistaken for a seal as the leopard seal tried its luck. In a report read into the inquiry into Brown's death, Professor Ian Boyd of the University of St. Andrews stated that seal may have mistaken her as a fur seal, then been frightened by her presence and then attacked. But there is no doubt that these animals are capable of killing a human, but it's only one instance where this has happened. Like all intelligent animals, we have to learn to live with these rare visitors into the non-frozen world. And in fact, in New Zealand, there is a lot of effort into document and monitor leopard seals that turn up in their waters, with groups like leopardseals.org having loads of publicly accessible information about what to do if you see a leopard seal. They have like a Twitter and Facebook and all of those different things. I'd urge you to go and have a look at it because it's quite good. They track individual leopard seals that turn up in and around New Zealand, and they're quite well known for turning up in places like Auckland Harbour and Wellington Harbour and just hauling out a bit like you see the Californian sea lions doing in Pier 49, maybe not in the same numbers. Fairly obvious things for you here. If you approach a seal, first off, don't. please follow simple guidance, and I've taken it word for word from their website. To enhance your safety and to enhance the safety of the seal, stay at least 20 meters away, keep dogs on a lead, and at least 20 meters away, if not further. Monitor children closely and keep them up to 20 meters away. If you have to approach, walk slowly and gently. Do not disturb seals by making loud noises or throwing things. Never attempt to feed a seal. Never attempt to touch a seal. Keep a clear path between you, the seal, and the water so it can leave if it wants to. If you're in a vehicle, do not approach within 50 meters because the sound can obviously disturb them as well. If you're photographing a leopard seal, use the zoom on your camera. Don't get any closer than 20 meters. So they are, oh, and most importantly, if you're in a marina and you find it on your pontoon close to your boat, contact the marina management for protocols. So they are an animal that does turn up from time to time outside of the frozen world that they live in. But they are an utterly fascinating creature at the same. I can say, luckily, I've seen one in the distance in Australia that came to South Australia. It was on a beach. And you could see it from a distance. They were keeping people off the beach as it was there. And then I believe it went back out to sea. So they
amazing.
Are an utterly fascinating creature. And ever since seeing that bit of footage of the Antarctic diver basically being offered a dead penguin by one, they've gripped me. So, yeah, there is the leopard seal for you.
Very cool animal.
Indeed. And another one to add to our, I would say, our growing list of pinnipeds, but so far it's leopard seal and walrus.
What surprised me most when I was looking into this, just to kind of clue myself up on what you'd be speaking about, is just how far that they do wander. Like you mentioned about Australia and New Zealand and that, but they've been spotted off the southern tips of Africa as well.
Oh, yeah, they've turned up, yeah. They even, I think I may have actually left it out, but they turn up in places like Tierra del Fuego as well and parts of southern South America. They're found right the way throughout. It just seems that, obviously, their preferred habitat is in and around those ice flows.
Yes.
Anyway, shall we pull ourselves out of the chilly waters of the Antarctic and head into our emails for this week?
Yeah, I think so.
Bing! You've got mail. Ooh, it's an email.
Right, well, we're into this week's emails. We're going to kick things off with the question from last week, which was, what animal were you most amazed to find out existed? This came off the back of our platypus episode, for the obvious reasons of that. So going down the very long list of comments we got this week, Matt, Jack, Jape, Quetzalcoatlus, can't believe something that large flew. They are, yeah, they do look like they shouldn't be able to fly from a physics point of view. Robin Clark has put Tenrix. Yep. Aaron Eschenbrenner Cocker has put Sawala, a really fantastic creature. Grace Coconis has put Men. Not so sure I agree with that one, but okay. My other half has put Diplocolus. Weird. I have a feeling I know where that came from because we were reading a book to our child that had a Diplocolus in it. And I've just had the signal that, yes, I was right there. John Bleckensop has put humans. Yeah, all right, that's fair enough. We are
that was my answer from last week as well.
Victor Praga has put, ooh. I don't get what that means.
Let's have a look.
It's just three O's.
Oh, ooh. Ooh.
Jen Babs has put frogfish and included a lovely photo of a little frogfish there, which I believe, didn't you say, Aaron, you'd never heard of a frogfish?
Never heard of a frogfish, no.
They're awesome little things. They're in the same group as like anglerfish.
Yeah, I remember you telling me.
David Lehman has put humans again. I think humans might win this. Although it wasn't a competition. Tom Gray has put, I think it could be most curious that in 4+ billion years on our planet of natural history, despite countless mass megafaunal extinctions, the blue whale is the largest animal to have ever existed and can still be found today. That is quite mad to think about, actually, that we are alive at the time of the largest living creature that has ever existed. And that's until we inevitably find the giant ichthyosaur. I know that'll happen. So Zara Jackson has put common cuttlefish, to which I believe, Aaron, you replied. Good call. Oh, no.
Yeah, I did reply, but I replied as the cupboard, not as me. So
you replied in
named
third
myself.
Person.
I replied in third person, like The Rock, but not as cool.
Please don't call yourself The Rock. So you put good call. You went to a not too different route with the octopus. That's quite true. Catherine Ames has then replied to that, saying, years ago I went to London Zoo. There were plenty of crowd-pleasing animals. Some on the conservation program, none of them captured my attention as much as the cuttlefish. I stood and stared at it for ages as it hovered in front of me, almost as though it was staring back. I'd say it was staring back at you, to be honest.
They're clever enough to be doing so, yeah.
Yeah, and Zara Jackson has put, I had to get a cuttlefish tattoo after working with them and seeing them out scuba diving. That is very cool. I can remember seeing some tiny little baby cuttlefish in a swimming pool that was fed by the sea. So every now and again, a wave would throw stuff in there. And if you're swimming around in there, you could see these tiny, tiny little baby ones. Oh. It was quite cool. Spencer Seams has put the giant versions of animals we have now. My favorite is the giant sloth. I'm assuming, Aaron, you've then replied.
Yeah.
Incredible, aren't they? The fact that some of these are much larger versions of what we see today that walked around, we actually have covered giant ground sloths in an earlier episode. Here's the link. There we go. Very nicely done, Aaron. Cat, I'm a house cat. that's the name that's there.
Who's posted a picture of a dog?
My dog. How she can be so amazing. That is a very fluffy dog, actually. I'm not quite sure of the breed. Cat, I'm a house cat. Our pets are incredibly important animals in our lives, and their time with us gives us a window into the ways and how they amaze us. Thanks for the photo. Always nice to see more of our audience lives and interests. Yeah, I don't know what kind of dog that is, but it's a really weird looking one, but I like it.
It's a bit of a chimeric look, isn't it?
Yeah. Philip Masek has put the Saiga antelope. Aaron, you've then replied, an extremely specialized antelope and something of an ancient leftover from a bygone era. Very true. Catherine Ames has put the ruby-tailed wasp. Not so much that they exist at all, but they are in my front garden in Scotland. They look too exotic for the location. Yeah, that is quite true. Some of these things do look out of place in some ways that they shouldn't be here. But I don't think that just because we live in the UK, we should have to accept drab wildlife. We have got some really exotic looking stuff. And yeah, that's basically what you ended up putting, Aaron. I hadn't even read that. She's then replied, the next time I see somebody from the Fife Coast and Countryside Trust, I'll try to remember to ask what species it is likely to be. And she's included some pictures of some of these wasps. Louise O'Leary has actually sent in the article that we had last week, although at the time she sent this in, it was the week last week. She beat us to the punch. But I've replied saying that it will be in the news of this week's episode, or last week's episode, if you're listening to this. And then Stan and Wolf has put, why is Boba Koa not an option? Now, I had to do a bit of diving into this.
I didn't know what that was when I read that.
Neither did I, but I think I figured it out. I spent a bit of time trying to figure out what this was. And I believe it's Polish for beaver. Boba is Polish for beaver. I could be wrong. So I've replied, is this Polish for beaver? And if so, beavers are always an option as an animal to pick. But I believe Boba Koa is sort of almost like a Polish meme about like a fat beaver. It's just a beaver sitting there. But if you type that into Google, there's multiple different rodents being confused with beavers that come up with it as well.
I decided it was a clone of some Mandalorian bounty hunter.
It does sound very Star Wars-esque, yeah. So, yes, there you go. There's our long list of animals that people couldn't quite believe existed, but are amazed by. And, I mean, it's a huge list anyway. So this week's question that we have for you. Okay, so this week's question, based on the fact that we got sent that lovely photo of cat, I am a house cat's dog, which I find, odd, but it is a very odd cat dog. Oh my god, I'm going into that cartoon. Send us a picture of your pets. Show everyone your favorite pets. Send us a picture and tell us what the breed they are, so we don't have to try and guess, or different species, because some of you, I would imagine, probably have reptiles or fish or birds or invertebrates. And let us see a picture of your pets. I would say that I would try and show everyone a picture now, but this is an audio format, so it doesn't really work as well. Aaron, your pets are many, I would say, but mostly your cats.
Well, there's only two now, isn't there? It's just the two cats. But historically, over the span of my life, it'd be many, yeah.
Hmm. Well, if you, dear listeners, want to send us in your pictures of your favorite pets, then you can do so on our Facebook page, where that question will be going up. And you can join the conversation on any of the other topics that we have going on throughout the week on our Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram pages. You can also find us as well on our fantastic Patreon. Aaron, tell us about our Patreons.
Well, our Patreons are very lovely people. They are supporting us financially and allowing us to do all manner of things with that in the near and hopefully distant future. And they are these four lovely people. We've got Chelsea McKee, Connie P, Jen Greenhall, and Fogtober. And once again, thank you so much to you guys for your continued support. It means the world to us.
Mm. And like I say, you can also help us out in various other ways. You can like, subscribe, or comment on whatever podcasting service you're listening to us on. Podcasts live and die on the word of mouth. So telling a friend, telling an enemy, telling a leopard seal in its weird sort of various different communication methods underwater will also work as well. Although probably don't do that just in case it bites you. You can find us on all our usual social media pages, as well as on our fantastic T-Mail store. And if you're wanting to see us in person, you can come and book tickets to see us at the Barnstable Library on the 13th of April, which is fast approaching, Aaron. Slightly scary.
It is a bit scary, yeah. It is a bit.
They shared some of our stuff this week. That was quite nice of them. This week's episode has been shared by them. All quite nice. Thank you very much, Barnstable Library. But that pretty much brings us to the end of this week's episode, Aaron.
It certainly does.
So, big thank you for coming along.
Thank you for having me once again. Thank you to our listeners for coming along on this continued ride into the crazy world of natural sciences.
And a big thank you to you at home for listening. And we'll see you next time here in the Natural History Cupboard. Bye.
Bye.
One does not simply live in the water and not fear an orca.